This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Many political watchers say no American statesman has been as revered and as reviled as Henry Kissinger. While his advice has been sought by every president from John Kennedy to Barack Obama, he's also been hounded by conspiracy theorists throughout his public life. Yet Neil Ferguson says in his biography, Kissinger, 1923 through 1968, The Idealist, the view of Kissinger as a ruthless arch-realist is based on a serious misunderstanding. Ferguson argues the true foundation of Kissinger's thought is philosophical idealism combined with history itself. I recently spoke with Neil Ferguson about the life and career of Henry Kissinger. Neil, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
To some, Henry Kissinger is a revered statesman, and to others, he's a ruthless arch-realist. Now, what do you say about him?
Well, I have been wading through or walking through a minefield, given the extraordinarily wide-ranging opinions there are on Kissinger. The late Christopher Hitchens had him down as a war criminal. Then you go back to the magazines and newspapers of the 1970s, and he's a superhero, so which is it? This is a two-volume work, and Volume 1 takes the story up to the moment that he's offered the job of National Security Advisor by Richard Nixon. And I argue that we need to see this Kissinger, the younger Kissinger, the Kissinger of the first half of his life, in a very different light. We need to see him as a refugee from Nazism. We need to see him as a guy who worked his way up from nothing, making shaving brushes in a factory in New York, who gets drafted, who is a rifleman under Nazi bombardment at the Battle of the Bulge, and who then climbs up the academic ladder, starting from scratch all over again back at Harvard after the war. And I think that Kissinger, whose formative experiences were really World War II and the Holocaust, emerges as, I think, a more sympathetic figure than certainly the Kissinger of Chris Hitchens' work. And as a man who was not at all a hard-nosed realist, Machiavellian, whatever you want to call him, actually Kissinger emerges, in my telling, as an idealist in the first half of his life, somebody who was an idealist on not only philosophical grounds, but also when it came to specific issues of policy.
Can you give me an example of why you would place him in the idealist camp of foreign policy?
I'll give you one specific example, though there are lots in the book. That there's a moment when he's watching the Kennedy administration overthrow or sanction the overthrow of the government in South Vietnam, in Saigon, the Diem regime, and the leader of that regime, Diem, and his brother were killed in this coup d'etat, which the Kennedy administration effectively green-lighted. And Kissinger condemns this in a draft speech for Nelson Rockefeller, arguing that if the United States does this kind of thing, it forfeits its moral authority. And it's that kind of language which seems to me to put him on the idealist side. Actually, he clashes with Hans Morgenthau, who is widely seen as the true academic realist on the issue of Vietnam. So that's one clear example. There are many more. There's some extraordinary interviews that he gives, including a TV interview with Mike Wallace back in the 1950s, when he says, you know, the problem with the Cold War is we're so negative. We do everything on the basis of anti-communism, and we never promote our own ideals. We never say these are the benefits of freedom for the individual. And individual freedom meant a lot to Kissinger. He, after all, he'd grown up to see his freedom removed by the Nazis after 1933. He'd had to flee his homeland to find freedom. Then he'd had to fight for it in an army uniform. And when he writes his senior thesis back at Harvard, The Meaning of History, The Central Argument of the Meaning of History, what a great title for a senior thesis, by the way, is that we as individuals really do have freedom. There aren't great forces of history that decide our fates. We decide them. We really do choose. So I think in those senses, he deserves to be seen as an idealist. That doesn't mean he's an idealist in Volume 2, because, after all, if you get a job invitation from Richard Nixon at the end of 1968, you're getting a job invitation from somebody who was, unquestionably, a realist and indeed an unscrupulous power broker.
Well, what was the relationship between Kissinger and Nelson Rockefeller?
It was a very close one, much, much closer than the relationship between Kissinger and Nixon, who hardly spoke to one another until the end of 1968. I think that Rockefeller was somebody who impressed Kissinger partly with his wealth and the kind of grand lifestyle he led. I think if you've started life as Kissinger did and gone through the experience of being a refugee and starting from scratch, you're bound to be kind of impressed by a Rockefeller. But I think that was a minor part of it. The major part of it was that he found himself in sympathy with Rockefeller's politics. Rockefeller was one of those Republicans that scarcely exist in our time. He was very close to the political center. He had no doubt that there was a big role for government to play. And on foreign policy issues, while he was hawkish, he wasn't ideological in the way that the later neoconservative movement would be. And so they kind of clicked on a whole number of levels. Rockefeller was not a great writer. In fact, he was not a great reader. He was dyslexic, and he needed to kind of bring in smart people to help run his campaign. So from an early stage in his academic career, back going into the late 1950s, Kissinger was helping Rockefeller, writing speeches for him, helping run his campaigns, acting as a kind of as a sort of separate extra brain for Rockefeller on all foreign policy issues.
He actually expected Rockefeller would become president, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I don't buy the story that Kissinger was a ruthless, calculating operator scheming his way to the top, because if he had been, he would not have kept backing Rockefeller three times as Rockefeller tried to run for the Republican nomination. And, you know, three times out of three, it didn't work out. I'm impressed by the fact that Kissinger stuck to Rockefeller, because by number three, it was clear to everybody else that he stood no chance. So Kissinger, I think, was loyal almost to a fault. And his last hope, it seemed, in 68, was that Nixon would give Rockefeller a job in his administration. Right up until the very last minute, they thought that was what was going to happen. And when the phone rang at Rockefeller's New York office from the Nixon camp as they were preparing the administration, they kind of assumed it was Nixon calling Rockefeller to offer him defense. And Kissinger was expecting to go work for Rockefeller when he was Secretary of Defense. But no, Nixon didn't want Rockefeller at all. He didn't like Rockefeller, and he didn't want anything to do with him. He wanted Kissinger as National Security Advisor. That was a very, very unexpected and surprising development, considering that there really had been no close relationship between the two men up until that point.
Now, Kissinger wanted you to write his biography, and if I understand the story correctly, Neil, you were going to turn him down because you considered this to be a daunting project.
I was right about that, and it's true. I did say no. This goes back more than 10 years when I first met him, we'd corresponded, and the idea had come up that someone might write a scholarly biography based partly on his private papers. And I must say my first reaction was, A, this is going to be a huge amount of work, and B, when it's published, Christopher Hitchens is going to write the most vicious review, and really it doesn't seem like anything would be worth this pain. But then I took a look at some of the private papers. He was quite clever about this, because he said, oh dear, I'm very sorry to hear you're not going to take it on, just as I found 150 boxes of my papers that I thought had been lost. And I fell for this, and I said, well, I'd better come and have a look, really, hadn't I? So I came and took a look at this material, and it really was so striking and extraordinary that I made up my mind there and then that I would do it, because nobody had really worked on any of this material before, particularly the early material, the letters to his parents during World War II, some of the unpublished essays. I found a diary of the 1964 Republican convention when Barry Goldwater was nominated, which was absolutely fascinating because Kissinger clearly couldn't bear the right-wing conservative movement that had produced Goldwater, and wrote about it with horror, almost as if he was reliving his childhood in Nazi Germany. So I thought, this is amazing stuff. I really, and not only amazing, but it really runs counter to what I'd been led to expect. So I was kind of hooked at that point.
Some people thought that Kissinger was the inspiration for Stanley Kubrick's mad nuclear strategist, Dr. Strangelove, that particular movie. I'm wondering, how did that notion come to be, and how far off base was that?
Yes, that is quite widely believed, but it isn't right. I think one can see why the idea came about, because Peter Sellers plays Dr. Strangelove with a very strong German accent. And, of course, one of the distinguishing features of Henry Kissinger is, you guessed it, a very strong German accent, and it's still almost his kind of signature today. But it's simply not the case that that Strangelove is based on Kissinger. It was probably Herman Kahn who inspired Stanley Kubrick, although there was probably also an element of Wernher von Braun, because remember, if you've seen the movie, you'll know this, but if you haven't, go and see it. It's an amazingly funny and brilliant film. But Dr. Strangelove is actually a former Nazi. As he sits there in his wheelchair, the thing that he keeps involuntarily doing is the Hitler salute. That, of course, is not Henry Kissinger, who'd been a refugee from the Nazis and was always extraordinarily hostile to totalitarian regimes. So I think this is a case of mistaken identity based mainly on the famous Kissinger accent.
What was the biggest surprise to you, Neil, as you did the research for this book?
I think it was pretty surprising to find Henry Kissinger in 1965 going on a fact-finding mission to Vietnam and concluding after it that the war could not be won and that a diplomatic solution would have to be found. That was much earlier than I had expected. And nobody had read through this diary, and particularly the unexpurgated report, the first draft of the report, which he ended up not sending, which was absolutely damning about the U.S. operation in South Vietnam. I think most people have an idea in their heads that goes right back to the politics of the early 1970s, that Henry Kissinger liked the Vietnam War so much that he wanted to keep it going. And this is kind of the student protest view of Kissinger. Bernie Sanders still takes this view. You may remember, bizarrely, that Sanders brought it up in one of his debates with Hillary Clinton, accusing her of being much too friendly with the evil Dr. Kissinger. But this doesn't chime with the historical evidence. In fact, Kissinger was, from 65 onwards, racking his brains as to how the U.S. could get out of this mess that Lyndon Johnson and others had got it into. And the fact that the war proved very, very hard to end has as much to do with the North Vietnamese implacable pursuit of victory as it has to do with Kissinger's desire to prolong the war. You know, the North Vietnamese essentially confronted the United States with a choice at the beginning of 1969: keep fighting or surrender. You know, just abandon South Vietnam. And I think it's very important to remind modern readers that there was no government imaginable in the United States that was simply going to surrender in 1969. That Nixon and Kissinger really didn't have an option to throw in the towel. And if the Democrats had won that election, it would have been exactly the same story.
So volume two yet to come. Can you give us a bit of a preview?
Well, I'll be very tentative because I have a tendency to make up my minds about things quite late after I've plowed through a ton of material and thought it through. But I think at this point, I'm going to call volume two The Realm of Power, because I think that is what Kissinger enters when he accepts the Nixon job. And I know that I'm going to begin by saying, let's just remember the world of January 1969. Let's remember what an extraordinarily weak position the United States found itself in, not only with respect to Vietnam, which was going horribly wrong, but also more generally, because the Soviets were making gains all over the world at that point in the Cold War, and the United States really did seem to be on the back foot. And economically, it was getting into more and more difficulty, too. That's point one. Point two is that at the beginning of the Nixon administration, Kissinger just isn't a powerful figure. He's a Harvard professor that they brought in, and they've given him this job, National Security Advisor, that is kind of ill-defined. And most people assume Richard Nixon is going to be in sole control of policy. After all, he was highly experienced in the legislature as well as in the White House, having been vice president. And Nixon was probably just going to use Kissinger as a kind of academic prop. So I think that's how the story begins. And then I have to explain how it is that Kissinger very quickly becomes, after Nixon, the most powerful man in the administration.
Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Been my pleasure.
Neil Ferguson. His new book is Kissinger, 1923 through 1968, The Idealist. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier, with help from Jim Nolan. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. And join us tonight at 7 for America Abroad, which will examine the relationship between the United States and Israel.